When I first came into the insurance industry back in 1995, this was a topic I didn't think I would ever be holding this kind of call to discuss, because it was seemingly an issue that just was not an issue. But today's call is going to be on insurable interest. And over the last couple of years, I can't tell you how many calls and how many instances the issue of insurable interest pops up, from the Chawla case to the issues of investor-owned life insurance. Insurable interest is one of the hottest topics out there, and I'm really excited to hear what your thoughts are on this as we go through today.
Well, Randy, it's probably going to take more than one podcast to do it, but this is a most fascinating and a most important topic. I'm going to start with a question of whether insurable interest is anachronistic. Is this something that's quaint but totally unimportant? I think the answer to that is pretty obvious, that based on recent cases and based on recent legislation, insurable interest is not only important, it's more important than ever.
Steve, it's interesting. When I was in private law practice, I worked for a very good estate planning lawyer, and he once told me that insurable interest was whatever the insurance company says it is.
Well, it's a lot more than that.
I think things have changed, haven't they?
Very much so. A lot of people don't even know there is such a thing as insurable interest. A lot of people think, as your former employer, that this is strictly something that's decided by an insurance company, their underwriting department, and it's strictly the insurer's problem. As we'll see in a few minutes, it's much wider than that, and it's certainly not only an issue which is decided by an insurance company. So it has great importance. It's important to tax attorneys, believe it or not, even though insurable interest is not a tax issue. It's important to life insurance agents. It's important to clients. It's very, very important based on what's going on in the world today. What's very interesting, and let's go back a little bit in time. In fact, let's go back a lot in time to 1761.
That's even before you were at John Hancock, right, Steve?
Even before I was at John Hancock. That's correct. In spite of the fact that my hair is all gray and my beard is totally silver at this point.
Yes, at least you have hair. You got one up on me.
But that's the date the first policy, commercial policy, life insurance policy, was issued in the United States. And very interestingly, not a single court and not a single state legislature since that first policy was issued has ever held or even implied that insurable interest is no longer important or needed. In fact, courts have very strongly, very zealously guarded insurable interest for all these years. Now, ultimately, whether or not we have insurable interest, whether or not there is such a law, is a public policy issue. And we could talk about that, and I think it is important that we discuss things like that from time to time. And I think that probably this 2007, 2008, 2009, all good times to discuss whether or not insurable interest is still important. Certainly the courts uniformly and the state legislatures uniformly up until this point, certainly they strongly feel it is. Let me back off the law for just a second and take an ethicist perspective. Ethicists see insurable interest as a device, almost like the brake. I was just in San Francisco and on one of those cable cars, and it's very much like the brake on one of those cable cars. It's designed, and triple interest is designed to stop the slippery slope that starts when interests conflict. And it's based on the concept that it's best that the beneficiary asks me, if I buy a policy on your life, Randy, it's best that I would rather have you live than have you dead to get the insurance money.
Sure seems to make sense.
So that's, in a nutshell, insurable interest is designed to create a break on that conflict of interest, to make sure that I have more to gain by you living than you dying. So in an ethicist perspective, life insurance and the purchase of life insurance, certainly by the insured, is an altruistic act. It's an act that's designed to benefit others.
Steve, I may be jumping ahead here, but I got a question. What, based on what you just told me, there's something that continues to confuse me. When I buy my homeowner's insurance, when I buy my car insurance, when I buy every property casualty type of insurance that I own and can think about, I have to have an insurable interest at the time of my claim.
You have to have it two times.
Right, when I buy it and when I make my claim.
And you're right. You're jumping ahead. We are going to get to that. But let me answer it right now. The general rule, and we'll come back to this, but the general rule with life insurance is you need insurable interest only at the time of purchase.
Why is human life less protected than my tangible assets? It just seems like so many of the problems that we see that deal with insurable interest could be fixed and could be stopped by simply by making insurable interest law in line with the insurance law that impacts my car and my home and my other assets.
Well, I think that you're leading me into my very next point, and that is insurable interest is designed to prevent the reduction of human life into an economic commodity. And you're right. You cheapen the value of human life if you say we only need insurable interest at the time of inception, but we treat property as more valuable because you need it both at inception and at the time of you know, you think somebody crazy. If somebody came to them and said, I want to buy insurance on your office building, and if your office building burns down, I will get the proceeds. I mean, you'd say, well, you can't do that. We won't let you do that. That's against public policy. But we have people trying to do the same thing with human lives. We have investors buying policies on strangers' lives and wanting to get the proceeds when that person dies. The point is that you're right. My opinion, there ought to be insurable interest at both times. But currently, what's happened is there's a balance. And in fact, in all of insurable interest, you will find a balance between commercial, the desire to use life insurance as property and to maintain the property aspects of life insurance, to not to take away the property aspects of life insurance, to safeguard the use of life insurance as property, and balance that against the public policy of protecting human lives. So to answer your question, you only need insurable interest currently at the time of issuance, but there are many people such as yourself and frankly myself who would feel much more comfortable if insurable interest was required at both times.
Just seems like it would make it a lot easier, at least, if than nothing else.
Well, we are in an era of rapid and significant change, and if I say the words COLI, EOLI, COLI being company-owned life insurance, EOLI being employer-owned life insurance, BOLI, bank-owned life insurance, POLI, trust-owned life insurance, POLI, partnership-owned life insurance, CHOLI, charitable-owned life insurance, and IILI, ELI, meaning investor-initiated life insurance, you see very quickly we get into this dichotomy between legalities and ethics. And we have this balance, and this is what you find if you study the cases, if you study what's going on in the legislatures right now. There is this constant attempt to balance between commercial interests and this drive to reduce a human life to an economic commodity that can be bought and sold, and this desire to protect human life and to protect the sanctity of human life. We come to some very inescapable conclusions. And one conclusion is that insurable interest serves a very important public purpose. Every state, either by court decision or by legislation, has enacted or enforced insurable interest. Why have they done so? Well, they want to do that because they want to thwart attempts to use life insurance to speculate on human lives.
I would say, though, that, Steve, although the point is that every state does have laws, as you and I both know, those laws are very diverse. I mean, you've got state laws where insurable interest is created simply by consent. Anybody and allow anybody else to own a life insurance contract on their lives to, and you know, to states where the laws are quite thick on who can own it.
And exactly what you just said points out what I've been saying, and that is we see it when we examine from state to state, and they are very different, but when we examine from state to state the insurable interest laws, we see this balance. On the one hand, how do we support attempts to use life insurance to speculate on lives? How do we use life insurable interest to protect human lives? But at the same time, there is this commercial bent. How do we safeguard the owner's property rights? And so we see this balance, and it's a seesaw, and it goes back and forth. And it's very, very interesting. Well, let me continue, and we'll revisit this issue. The core concepts and the themes of insurable interest will vary from state to state. You will see these core concepts carried over, by the way, into the federal tax system. Amazingly, insurable interest has always been a state concept, a state law concept, but now it is being carried into the federal tax system with wide variations from state to state, from court to court, from time to time. And when you talk about insurable interest, you can't do it in a vacuum. You must start with what's the appropriate state. What state are we talking about?
Steve, can I ask you a question on that? Because that's a place where I've been confused myself over the last couple of years when I've looked at insurable interest issues. Is it the state of the insured's domicile? Is it the state where the insurance is being bought? Is it not even that easy? What state law does control this?
Usually it will be the state of domicile. The exception, there are really two exceptions. That one exception is where the life insurance is owned by a trust, and then you go by trustitis.
But Steve, what if the trust is used for the purpose of selecting a state that has a less stringent insurable interest statute? Wouldn't, like most things, wouldn't you look at the form over the substance, and wouldn't the state have the right and the power to impose insurable interest laws on its, you know, on the citizens of that state?
Absolutely. And you will see some very confusing and difficult law here. So we start with what's the appropriate state, and as you point out, that's not an easy decision. Again, in most cases, it will be the state of the insured's domicile, unless some other state has a more significant interest in the proceedings of the parties. And we saw that in a Coley case where a Texas court said, we're not going to go by the fact that the company has set up its trust in Georgia, which had much more relaxed insurable interest laws, because this guy lived in Texas. He died in Texas. He worked for Walmart in Texas, so we're going to use, you know, Texas law. We have all these indicia. So you will see this diversity issue, this question of which state's law applies. But if you're an insurance agent or a lawyer, you have to that's your first question, your first hurdle. I must determine first the appropriate state. Then I have to look at that state's latest law and latest cases. Now, there's another tier, as I just mentioned, the federal government has gotten into the act, for example, with what was once called COLI, company-owned life insurance. Now we have a specific backdoor insurable interest law, code section 101J, and it's now called EOLI, employer-owned life insurance. So we have to check to see if there's a federal law. There's even a law right now. It was promulgated in the Pension Protection Act with respect to charity and insurable interest, and it imposes a reporting requirement. And there's a study that's going on with respect to charitable-owned life insurance, where the truth is that strangers are financing and strangers will eventually be the owners.
Those are some interesting inroads on the idea of state regulation of life insurance as opposed to federal.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, the trend in insurable interest is very interesting. A lot of people think insurable interest is there to protect the insurance company and to allow the insurance company to deny a claim if there is no insurable interest. Well, it is true, as we saw in the Chawla case, Chawla, the Chawla case, Geisinger, it is true that a company can deny the payment if there is no insurable interest, but the trend, the distinct trend in the courts is to require payment. That is, the company's going to pay somebody, and often the payment is made to the insured's estate or to a contingent beneficiary if the original applicant owner or the named beneficiary has no insurable interest. But what you're seeing here is a huge temptation to commoditize human lives, and that temptation is increasing. Again, I come back to strain your own life insurance. I'm just going to mention a little bit about it because we've covered it in the past, and it's a subject for perhaps a future discussion. But I just want to mention that this whole insurable interest area not only has legal implications, it has incredibly strong emotional overtones. I spoke to a absolutely brilliant law professor who can't understand why there is insurable interest. He says, you know, as far as I'm concerned, any stranger can buy insurance on my life. And he was not speaking legally. He was speaking, he would be comfortable with that. Well, I, for one, can't see that. My point is that people do take very strongly different positions on this. And we have to recognize that. So this temptation to commoditize human lives is increasing. The spirit of insurable interest is often abused. And I just want to mention that it wasn't that long ago that people used to buy graveyard insurance. Well, what's graveyard insurance? Well, graveyard insurance is where they used to go. They used to go to paupers' houses, and they would find the poorest, sickest people or people on the edge or people about to become alcoholics, and they would insure them. And then there was a case in 1885 about the same time that this graveyard insurance was going on, a case called Warnock v. Davis, and it was a Supreme Court case. And this involved a 27-year-old man and a group of investors who came to this guy and said, look, we want to buy some insurance on your life, but we can't do it directly, so if you'll go out and buy it on yourself, we'll pay all the premiums, and the deal will be that you assign 10% of the proceeds to your wife, and we'll keep the other 90%, but you'll have no outlay for the insurance.
What was the year on that, Steve? I thought you said 1881. That sounded like that must have been 2005.
No, it does sound like 2005, but you see this investor-owned life insurance is not something new. It started with graveyard insurance. Then it went to a 27-year-old guy. That was 1885, by the way. Then we have in the 1930s a case called Hack v. Metz, and that's a very interesting case because investors were buying insurance not on people who were almost at the death's door, not at on 27-year-olds. They were buying it on 11-year-old children. This group of investors had bought 300 policies. So this commoditization of human life is not something that's new. It's been around a long, long time. Well, life insurance, of course, is very essential because from an individual point of view, there is no way that we can maintain our lifestyle and realize our dreams if somebody dies without life insurance. And businesses, life insurance makes the risk of business bearable. But there has always been this desire to use life insurance as a gambling tool. And let me again go back in time, and we started out with, when is the Pope going to die? It actually did. It started out with when will the Pope die, and can I buy insurance on the life of the Pope? And believe it or not, the Pope was the first person who said, we have a new rule here. We have a papal edict that thou shalt not buy life insurance on the lives of anybody in the papacy or anybody in the Catholic Church, for that matter, for purposes of gambling.
But Steve, he is infallible, after all.
Well, I won't get into that, but in early England, the same thing was happening. Anything goes, and they were buying live policies on lots of people. But it got so bad that in 1477 they enacted the first insurable interest law. It was called an Act Against Unlawful Gains. Then later in England, another act against wagering. So then you have some strong actions against buying insurance on the life of everybody who's walking around. But you see the same thing there that you see coming back in the United States. And I just want to show you how history repeats itself. In 1688, things got wild. Commercialism was everything. And they said that anything goes, policies wagering on the life of a human being are no longer void. And in 1688, trafficking in human lives in England became vicious. Now, they insured rich people, they insured famous people, they insured politicians, they insured the elderly, they even insured criminals that were sentenced for various crimes, betting that they would be executed. And it really got so bad that in 1774, England came back with another insurance act, which is really the basis of all the insurable interest laws we have today. And that act said that no policy will be issued absent insurable interest, and if such a policy is issued, that policy is null and void.
Steve, that's an interesting point. Can you clarify that one? Under most insurable interest statutes, because they still do read that way, if there's no insurable interest, the policies are null and void. That means even after the lack of insurable interest is discovered, even if it's outside of the contestable time frame, doesn't that mean that that policy is still null and void, even though it's discovered outside of the two-year contestable time frame in most states?
This is a very common misunderstanding. A lot of people think that they can beat this, and that's why you hear in these investor-initiated life insurance policies, where you wait 2 years and then sell it, on the mistaken belief that once you've passed that two-year contestable period, you're home free. Nothing could be further from the truth for the exact reasons that you just pointed out, and that is, if there is no insurable interest, you never had a contract. The incontestable clause is a clause inside the contract, but if you have no contract, that incontestable clause is meaningless. There never was a policy. So, Randy, you're absolutely correct. Absent insurable interest, there never is a contract, therefore you're not protected by any incontestable clause. Well, in 1844, believe it or not, there used to be public auctions of life insurance policies, and speculators would buy them.
That was even before the Internet.
Yeah, exactly. That's even before the Internet. Well, it wasn't too long before people realized how absurd and obscene that was. And so since the middle 1800s, every state in the Union has had an insurable interest law. Now, let me talk about one of the reasons is pretty obvious, and that is we don't want people killing other people. But the other major reason is gambling. The legislatures have not wanted life insurance to be a gambling tool. And the first thing that you hear from a lot of people who say to you, well, life insurance is gambling. And the answer is that couldn't be further from the truth. Gambling is the creation of risk that did not previously exist. Let me repeat that. Gambling is the creation of risk that did not previously exist. Life insurance is the exact opposite. Life insurance is combining many similar exposure units. Life insurance is transferring risk that exists already to an insurance company. Life insurance is reducing risk through the law of large numbers, getting into the law of large numbers and using the law of large numbers. Life insurance is sharing potential losses among lots of exposure units. So life insurance is the exact opposite of gambling. So the purpose of insurable interest is to prevent a previously non-existent risk. It's the exact opposite of gambling. Prevent a previously non-existent risk. So how do we define insurable interest? Well, it's a connection. It's the reasonable right based on this connection, this nexus, this relationship between the beneficiary of the insurance and the insured, this connection and this reasonable right to expect a pecuniary advantage from the continuation of the insured's life, or the reasonable reasonable right to expect some kind of loss by the insured's death. In other words, are you going to lose something if this person dies, or do you have a lot to gain if this person lives? And let me refine that a little bit. Insurable interest is having a greater interest in keeping this person alive than taking it in order to obtain the proceeds of the insurance. Now, it really breaks down into blood, affinity, and pecuniary relationship. So we might also define, and every court has defined insurable interest in a slightly different way, and legislatures, if you look at each one, you'll see variances in them. But essentially, we're looking for a reasonable ground founded on the relationship of the parties to expect, and the key words are advantage, from the continued life of the insured. Absent an advantage from the continued life of the insured, if you have no expectation of advantage from this person continuing to live, a life insurance policy is no longer a life insurance policy, it's a wager. And the courts have said that a wager policy has the tendency to create the desire for the early death of the insured, the event itself. So what we're trying to do here, what insurable interest is all about, is a balance. It's a balance between business and economics, and a balance between the public policy of preventing a risk that wasn't there before, the risk of somebody killing somebody, and secondary principle, the secondary purpose of preventing gambling. Now, you mentioned before, in fact, you started with the concept that some people think that insurable interest has to do only with insurers. And it is true that insurers have a great interest in insurable interest because it is a business and economic decision from an insurer's point of view. They must demand an insurable interest. They also have overtones of moral overtones, and there are, of course, legal implications. So what you have here is two things going on at the same time. The insurer is interested in insurable interest for economic reasons. The public is interested in insurable interest to safeguard morality and to prevent people killing each other. The insurer's perspective of insurable interest is very different from the public. The insurer is concerned about basing premiums on expected losses at given ages. The insurer is based on using the law of large numbers to go about its business. Well, if we didn't have insurable interest, if the insurer didn't demand insurable interest, its premium assumptions, the rates that it creates, the assumptions that those rates are based on, would be frustrated. Why would they be frustrated? Because if the insured or the beneficiary can influence the probability that the insured will die and can accelerate the death of the insured, all those rates and all those assumptions and all that law of large numbers goes out the window. So the insurer has got to demand an insurable interest. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Let's say you're a nurse and you're a medical caregiver, and this insured is in your total care. He has the family doesn't live nearby. You're taking care of this person, and you go out and you buy a policy on his life. So you're either the assignee of a policy or the applicant owner of a policy on this insured patient. By withholding medicine or by just neglecting this person, you can affect when this person will die. If the insurance company didn't demand of you, when you buy a policy, insurable interest, you could just do this and just by sheer neglect affect their finances. You could skew their premium. So, and of course, the extreme example of that is where an applicant takes out a policy or convinces the insurer to apply for a policy and assign it to them, and the applicant has a predetermined intent to murder the insured. So the insurer's perspective of insurable interest is, how do we eliminate the moral hazard? How do we eliminate a person who has a bad character, and how do we eliminate this temptation to create a risk that wasn't there before? So from an insurer's point of view, insurable interest helps preserve the integrity of the risk pool. It keeps the numbers honest. Now, from the public's point of view, you have a whole different perspective. From the public, the interest is, as I've said before, how do we protect human lives? How do we preempt? How do we preempt? How do we preempt the incentive for either negligence or murder?
And what's less important as well from a public policy standpoint, though, is to take those sorts of risks out of the pool helps stabilize and keep cost-effective the cost of the insurance for everybody at large, because if insurers had to start to price for those sorts of risks, it would impact everybody's costs.
That's exactly one of the great dangers of investor-initiated life insurance, that it will destroy the assumptions upon which sound life underwriting and the present rates are based, and insurance companies will, of course, have to do exactly as you said. They'll have to increase the premiums. This is what's going on, and from a public policy perspective, the courts have said policies that violate this insurable interest rule are not dangerous because they're illegal. They're illegal because they're dangerous. There is one other little thing that and I think you've alluded to it, Randy, and that is, insurable interest helps legitimize life insurance. In what respect? Well, it assures the public that life insurance is not a form of speculation. It's not a form of wagering. This is a good place for us to pause, review what we've talked about, and then in our next session we're going to go on and we're going to talk about what is meant by wagering, what are the tests of a wagering contract, what kind of interest is insurable. Let me go back to Randy's point about when must insurable interest be present, because there is no hard and fast rule there. There's a general rule, but there are some exceptions. Does insurable interest terminate? Can insurable interest terminate? What about knowledge and consent? Do we need knowledge and consent? We're going to go in our second session, we're going to go into more detail about these things. And then I think in our third podcast, what I'd like to talk about is nuts and bolts, nits and lice. Does a parent have insurable interest on children? Do children have insurable interest on parents? And we'll take that all the way through to almost every conceivable situation and talk about how insurable interest works today in today's marketplace.